I was doing. And Glover Johns, in case you didn't know, you made us like it too. I'll call Colonel Johns's DA-issued replacement Gus O. Newbreed. Watch out, fingers ball. Newbreed did not look like a soldier. Short and dumpy with blue eyes, red blonde hair, heavy jowls, and a rumpled uniform, he always reminded me of a potato sack. He did not act like a soldier either. He was a staff officer, had no infantry combat experience, and was simply not qualified to command a battle group of combat troops. He carried pockets full of candy and handed it out to troopers as he talked to them in the field being any troop position he could reach by jeep and not have to walk. Instead of endearing the guys to him, this practice only earned him the derisive nickname Candy Bar 6. While Johns could run a unit in the field with his eyes closed, Newbreed stumbled, bumbled, and screwed up everything he tried with eyes wide open. As CO of Combat Support Company, I worked with him directly on maneuvers. Combat support platoons operated separately in the field as dictated by the tactical situation. Newbreed would ask things like, "Where's the INR platoon?" which the Army had disappeared 5 years before, or, "Where's the SCR 300 radio?" which went out not long after Korea. And it wasn't as if it was tough to stay up on the profession if a guy wanted to. There were professional magazines and journals, correspondence courses galore, but I guessed this guy, bottom line, didn't care. His standard response to voice disappointment and disapproval was, "Oh, balls," in a tone of voice bordering on the effeminate, and when pushed, he had temper tantrums that rivaled Colonel Willard's. People started scrambling to get out of the battle group. Those who remained talked mutiny and feared going into combat with this guy in charge. "Don't worry," said one. "He wouldn't last a day, and you can bet your sweet ass it ain't gonna be enemy who gets him." He was just such an embarrassment. The young officers were disillusioned. Guys from other battle groups jeered loud and long at the clubs. The formidable 1st of the 18th was losing its grip. Thank God for Colonel Couch, we'd think, who stayed on as Deputy Battle Group CO under Newbreed. Couch didn't look much like a Prussian soldier either, and certainly not when compared to Johns, who was a casting director's dream for the perfect military man. Couch was of medium build and Grant-looking. He wore glasses and always seemed to have a huge cigar hanging out of his mouth. But he knew his trade inside and out, and if he ever felt rusty with the basics, he took personal remedial action. He and his driver used to carry practice grenades in their jeep. On the way to the training areas, they'd stop, pick out targets, go prone, or kneel behind trees, rocks, or other cover, and throw these dummy grenades. This was pretty exceptional behavior, but perfectly logical to Couch, who explained, "I'd been sitting on my tail for about 5 years in a staff job. Pitching grenades requires practice. I needed to get back in the groove." And he added, "It was really a rather closely guarded secret, but old Glover and I would practice with the pistol quite a bit, too." Couch had played tough guy to John's benevolent father role. The first 6 months I spent with the 1st of the 18th, I'd been scared to death of him, until I came to understand his subtle sense of humor and to realize that he, too, had a heart of gold. One time in D Company, on a brutally cold, snowy day, I'd started moving my boys out for a few days' training in the field when Colonel Couch came driving by in his jeep. "Where are you going, Captain?" he asked. "Training, sir." "In the snow?" "Yes, sir. It's on the training schedule. And besides, sir," I added, being a smartass, "it does snow in combat." "Good point. But I want to tell you something, Hack. To learn, you don't have to suffer." That particular concept had never crossed my mind. I'd always had a Spartan kind of attitude toward soldiering, on a personal level anyway, given that one of the first things I tried to do in a new unit was make the garrison lifestyle for everyone as comfortable as possible. When I joined the 1st of the 18th, I'd gone back to shaving with cold water and sleeping on the ground on maneuvers, figuring that I might as well get used to it in case we ended up in a battlefield situation. "What are you going to be teaching out there?" Couch asked. "Rifle platoon in the attack and weapons platoon crew drill, sir." "Fine. Now, you just take these boys back to their barracks, chalk-talk it with them. They'll love you for it. but don't tell them I said that. Just take them to the front gate, stop the company, call all the lieutenants together and say, gentlemen, do you think it's too cold to train? They'll all say yes. Then you say, well, I think so too, and take them back. Everybody will think you're a wonderful leader, and you'll get a lot more value out of the thing than you would freezing all your nuts off out in the boonies. Right, sir. Couch had proved right, on all counts. It was a great lesson learned for me, and a morale boost for my near-frozen chosen. How fortunate we would have been had the deputy succeeded Colonel Johns as battle group commander. This was a fairly normal procedure. But Couch himself had bent more than a few noses out of joint, and so was not considered for the job by higher HQ. The reason stated was that the job called for a full colonel, and Lieutenant Colonel Couch had 6 months' time in grade left before promotion. Now, the bitch of it all was that although Couch was still there to hold the unit together in terms of tactical proficiency, he could not counter the morale bust of the new CO. But we'd take what we could get. In only a few months, the 1st of the 18th would be taking its annual Battlegroup Army training test, in which we'd be judged for combat readiness. The ATTs, through which careers could be made or broken, were the most important tests in the peacetime army. The 1st of the 18th had missed the 1961 exercise because of Berlin. In 1960, under Colonel Johns and Couch, the 1st of the 18th had proved itself the best battle group in 7th Army. At the best of times, that would be a hard act to follow. Add to that new breed and the fact that we were still pretty rusty from our Berlin stint as parade ground garrison warriors, and Colonel Couch's intensive tactical training was the only hope we had. Even as the battle group made preparations for its August test, smaller-scale ATTs were also going on at the company level. Couch designated me chief evaluator for these ATTs. It was a challenging, interesting, and fun job until B Company's turn came around. Since Dick Coker had been reassigned to division, Bravo Company had been commanded by a captain I'll call Hale. Hale was loud, affected, and incompetent. His troops had his number and hated him for it. My own first serious encounter with him had been during the platoon ATTs, for which he was officer in charge and I was an observer. When an aggressor detail hit the platoon of an old Hawaiian ex-wolfhound master sergeant named Solomon, Hale had rushed up to demand Solomon fire his machine guns. "Make some noise," he'd said. To begin with, Solomon already had the problem under control. Also, the platoon sergeant, who'd had far more combat than Hale would ever care to see, knew the role of the machine gun was not to make noise, that it was considered the last weapon a platoon in the defense should employ. Solomon had turned to me. "I don't want to teach my men bad habits, sir," he'd explained, and because I totally agreed, I backed him up all the way. Understandably, I was not overly impressed with Captain Hale, nor he with me. B Company was one of the first units to take its ATT. The test, which lasted about 5 days, was an unquestionable fiasco. Bravo's commander could do nothing right. If the unit was not lost, it was attacking the wrong objective. If the guys were not attacking the wrong objective, they were withdrawing and leaving half the unit behind, because Hale hadn't given them the word. Their final mission in the test was to attack and secure a small hill on the Baumholder training grounds. The CO roared to the foot of the objective with his company riding in APCs. The troops deployed at the base of the hill, about 700 yards from the top, and then, in the best picket at Gettysburg tradition, they started marching in a skirmish line, straight up. I was on top of the objective with a handful of the aggressor detail. We watched the suicidal maneuver below us in amazement. Had just we few soldiers been enemy defenders in actual combat, we would have wiped out Hale's entire command. It was true that I didn't like B Company CO, just as I'd not liked that oddball Hartman. Yet to flunk him on the ATT would completely end his career, and it was not the kind of a decision to be made lightly. But the company was sick. According to all my subordinate platoon umpires, it had failed every test. In combat, that would equal a lot of dead men. Looked at that way, the The unanimous decision among all the umpires and myself to flunk the company was more or less made for us. And did the shit hit the fan? Besides being loud, affected, and incompetent, Hale was also black. When he was relieved, he immediately submitted a reclamation that held that I was racially prejudiced and had so influenced all the other umpires. This pissed me off to no end, because among all the things that I was, and I was able to name a lot of them these days, one thing I was not was racially prejudiced. When now and then one of the black guys in the first of the 18th would beg the regs and grow a little goatee just below his bottom lip, but above the chin so it couldn't be classified as a beard, my SOP was to go to the soldier, give his beardlet a tug, and warn him that if it wasn't gone before the sun went down, his ass was going to be grass, with me playing lawnmower. Black or white, I wasn't going to stand for that crap, and no one ever accused me of anything more than doing my job. These guys may not have liked me, I didn't care, but it was a hell of a lot fairer than following the widespread cover-your-ass CYA procedure of nailing the white kids and leaving the black guys alone. I would have failed Hale if he were white. I would have failed him if he were green. I just had no tolerance for leaders who'd get kids killed on the battlefield. Soon after the ATT incident, for example, when I heard from one source too many that a white weapons platoon leader in one of the companies was grossly incompetent, I sent Peppers over to have a look. The class he observed was on 81mm mortar fire direction. What he found was that the lieutenant in question was not using the required sharpened pencil to plot his points. Instead, he was teaching his men to use grease pencils. It was like teaching surgeons to perform open-heart surgery with baseball gloves on. When translated into a combat situation, these big grease pencil dots on a plotting board could throw the mortar fire off by hundreds of yards, meaning it could easily land not where required, but smack dab in the middle of friendly troops maneuvering underneath. I'd had my share of friendly fire back in Korea, and no way was I going to set this supremely stupid individual free to kill or maim our own boys in the field. After numerous other reports of gross deficiencies on this lieutenant's part, I raised hell until he was relieved. A board upheld our decision to fail Hale's company. Soon after, he left the battle group, and a couple of years later, he left the army completely. Colonel Newbreed had been in a state of panic throughout the investigation and had refused to back me up on our initial findings. It really was more than a little tiring to serve under this categorical wimp and his new XO, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Sniffen, who was married to a senior general's daughter and had been away from troops even longer than old Gus. Luckily, the Sniff, as we all came to call him, I found out later that he'd nicknamed me, too, Sackworth, after the hail and mortar lieutenant affairs, was in a staff role, and we were spared his dubious command talents for a long while. Robbie Robinson was about to go home, so I needed a new RTO driver. I figured that since I'd be spending a lot of time with the new guy, I'd get someone really smart who could fill me in on all the books I hadn't read, which were most, besides military stuff. And if he were really articulate, maybe that would rub off on me too. So I went to personnel and asked for a man with a degree in English literature. My reward was a Brown University graduate named David Ullman. I was stoked, and for a couple of weeks we drove down the highway and through the field, Ullman giving me instant courses in things literary while Sterling, having broken the Ivy Leaguer in on the killer Jeep, the radios, and our SOPs, hung out in the back seat waiting to go home. One day on maneuvers, we went up to the top of a hill so I could transmit a couple of radio messages. On the way back down, it became quite evident that my new driver was losing control of the vehicle. The old M38 Jeep could negotiate cross-country driving. The latest and greatest M151 could not. The Jeep went into a slide. Ullman turned his wheels, and as night follows day, the thing flipped over. Robbie and I were lucky. We were thrown out. When I'd recovered from that, I looked up on the hillside to see Ullman trapped underneath the overturned vehicle. Gas was pouring out of the Jeep, and the big command radios were throwing sparks. It looked as if we were about to see a pretty spectacular bonfire. Robbie and I ran up the hill. Ullman's legs were pinned under the jeep. I picked up the back end of the thing and, with Robbie, slid the guy out. Pretty staggering what a human being can do under stress when the adrenaline starts pumping. I tried to lift the back end of that jeep again when the emergency was over and couldn't budget an inch. I looked at the boy and knew he was gone. Ullman wore that ashen death look I'd seen too many times. I started up all the old battlefield stuff. "You're doing great, kid. You're going to make it," while I watched him check out of the net. Then he started praying. I thought it was Hebrew, but I didn't know. The main thing was, he knew I was bullshitting him, and he was going to die. At the same moment, I heard an army helicopter flying overhead. Maybe God was listening. Miraculously, I got the pilot on the radio without even knowing his frequency. When I popped a smoke, he came down and whisked the kid off to the hospital. The long and short of it was Ullman didn't die. His pubic bone had been broken in the accident and had become like two razor blades cutting his insides apart. He had massive internal injuries and ended up pretty badly crippled for a few years, but ultimately got on his feet again. Still, the bottom line of the incident was that it shouldn't have happened. All this boy's pain was due to a newfangled army-issued piece of junk, which had everything and could do anything except get you from point A to point B in safety. I called it Wonder Gear, all the Army's experiments that made it past the prototype phase and into the hands of human guinea pig troopers. Much in general terms was useless, some incredibly dangerous. In combat support, I had the opportunity to see a hell of a lot of both. The SPAT, for instance, was a 90mm anti-tank gun sitting on a full-track chassis. The concept was great. It was modeled after the German 88mm, which darted in and out of the action and wreaked havoc all over European battlefields in World War II. But the American version had a gun too heavy for its base. Spare parts unavailable through the normal requisition system. The weapon had actually become obsolete during its short life and was being phased out for the SS-10 and SS-11 anti-tank missiles, and a weak track system that almost invariably had us towing the things back from maneuvers as if they were beached whales. Another bit of Wonder Gear, the brand new M113 APC, was a totally unnecessary vehicle and a first-class disaster waiting to happen. To begin with, infantry didn't and don't need armored personnel carriers. In fact, the last thing an army should want is foot soldiers dependent on vehicles. The tried-and-true method for carrying infantry squads into battle was to have them ride piggyback on the backs of tanks. If the spearhead of my company had been in APCs on 6 February 1951, every single one of us would have been dead. If an APC hit a mine, you'd lose a squad. As it was, by default, you invariably lost one or more effective members of an 11-man squad just to the driving and maintenance of the vehicle. And then there was the M113's basic design, which was so miserable that you'd almost believe all America's enemies had joined together to have it built. The thing looked like a huge shoebox, on the battlefield, an irresistible high-profile target. But the worst thing about the new APC, which we and the Army didn't know in 1962, but would find out at great cost in lives, was that the M113 was also a crematorium on tracks. The M113 APC was made of a highly flammable magnesium alloy. In the next war, based on the vehicle's fiery track record from its earliest sparks of battle, drivers would reach the point where they'd refuse to get inside it. Instead, they'd sit on the heavily sandbagged top and control the thing with wires they'd attached to the steering column and gears below. Still, among the many wonder weapons available at this time, the greatest of them all was the atomic cannon, the Davy Crockett. As early as 1956, this sub-kiloton frontline tactical nuclear weapon was in production, but only now was it being issued at the troop level. Combat Support Company 1st of the 18th Infantry was to be the first unit in the European theater tested for operational readiness in its use. Gus O called me on the phone. Our careers hinged, or so he said, on getting a Davy Crockett platoon together that would pass a technical proficiency inspection, TPI, in about 3 months' time. This was very serious stuff. I had my pick of any men in the battle group for platoon leader and other personnel. The first thing I did was grab Tim Grafton out of D Company and make him CO. We got top priority for replacements. Tim picked about 15 top stud troops for his command from the new guys, or through stealing the best from other companies. According to New Breed, the only off-limits man in the entire battle group was the colonel's own driver. We were issued a fine old combat paratrooper NCO named Bolts, who'd been trained at Benning on the Davy Crockett and would be our resident expert on the system. Tim and he organized firing teams and began to train day and night. They used dummy warheads, large watermelon-shaped projectiles that fit onto a rocket launcher mounted on a jeep or tripod. It was designed to throw the thing out there far enough to use the warhead without hurting us, Tim would say later. But I don't think the system ever could have worked correctly. It didn't seem likely, for a number of reasons, just one being the SOP for permission to fire. It went like this. The section leader who first saw Soviet tanks roaring over the West German hills would ask Tim for permission to fire. Tim would then call and ask me. I would ask New Breed. New Breed would call Goodpaster at division, who would then call the Corps CG, who'd call the 7th Army CG, who'd call the NATO CG, who'd call the Pentagon, who'd call the President, who'd make his decision and send it back down the chain of command. By the time the unit got the green light, some 2.5 hours later, and coordinated with nearby units to make sure their guys knew not to look at the fireball, the Soviet tanks originally sighted by the gunner would be in Paris. On the other hand, as Field Marshal Montgomery had said regarding atomic weaponry, that he'd fire first and ask questions later. It was kind of hard to envision a nervous corporal while watching Soviet tanks barrel into his position, waiting patiently for permission to nuke them. The key thing about the Davy Crockett, said Tim, is that the weapons system itself was designed by a bunch of intellectual pinheads who'd never seen a battlefield. And if they thought that young troops on the battlefield could throw one of these nuke devices out about 3,000 meters and not have the effects of the nuclear blast on themselves or their own unit, they were crazy. Nonetheless, the training went on, the TPI took place, and Tim and Bolts passed it with flying colors. Tim was the only man in the theater ever to fire a live Davy Crockett HE training round. The only problem left, then, was where the unit would get live atomic warheads if it needed them. Even Tim, as platoon leader, did not know where they were kept, or an SOP for procuring them in an emergency. Curiously, I found out many years later from a man who helped develop the Davy Crockett, who was not an intellectual pinhead, and had, in fact, spent many years on battlefields, which to me made the weapon's uselessness even more unfathomable, that live warheads could have been procured within about 2 hours. It was good, if not somewhat belated, news. The Russians would still have gotten to Paris, but maybe we would have been able to stop them before they started to mix vodka with Dom Perignon. Quickly realizing the system's limitations, the Defense Department stopped all Davy Crockett production within 2 years of its deployment. Within 4 years, the Davy Crockett was withdrawn from Germany entirely. About this time, word came down that General Yakubovsky, chief of the Soviet Army in East Germany, had accepted an invitation to inspect our battle group. Project Yankee, as it was called, would prove to be the greatest show on Earth. While 4.5 years before, Chief of Staff Maxwell D. Taylor had spoken about the difficulty of obtaining new-look funds for the day-to-day needs of conventional ground forces, and cited as an example a suggestion he'd heard regarding motor transport replacement. The only way to be sure of getting such a program is to have our research and development people produce a truck with an atomic warhead. Now we of the 1st of the 18th had a better surefire approach. Invite a Russian general for lunch. Even with Kennedy's injection of funds, the army was still ridiculously poor. We'd become used to knocking off the Coleman Barracks ordnance parks and motor pool in nighttime raids, simply to keep ourselves operational. Everyone else did it, too. Another problem with the SPAT was that ours had been nocturnally cannibalized by the 504th and 505th battle groups. But now, nothing was too good for us. It had been decided Yakubovsky would inspect Combat Support Company because we had all the battle group's goodies. I took full advantage of our good luck to bitch about the equipment problems and shortcomings I had previously been resigned to, and the weeks preceding the general's visit were like Christmas. Carryover equipment from World War II was replaced with ultra-new stuff. If the seat of a Jeep was slightly worn, we were given a new seat. On the basis of the tiniest scuffs or scratches, entire vehicles were repainted or replaced. It was wonderful. But the greatest show was about the greatest sham. All the barracks were painted, but only the sides visible to the Russian on his flight path in. A patch of dirt near the HQ, which was used for a parking lot, was also painted, green, to look like lush grass from the air. Combat support was immediately issued dozens of 6-foot-tall Russian-speaking CIC agents to replace our less regal-appearing troopers. We trained them in their jobs so that when the general made his inspection, he could speak directly to the U.S. troops and conclude that every one of us in this average old battle group was a multilingual stud. Charismatic Tim Grattan, who really was head and shoulders above the very best of the battle group's fine young officers, as well as being quite high on new breed's list since the Davy Crockett test, was appointed escort officer. General Yakubovsky was so impressed with him that when the flawless tour was over, he offered Tim the job of CO in a Soviet rifle company if the American lieutenant would come over to the other side. Of course, Colonel Newbreed just puffed with pride. Like Tim, I'd managed to stay on the right side of old Gus. I tried as hard as I could to be respectful, and only faltered when he started acting crazy or interfering with my command. When former Senator William Noland from California was due to pay a visit to the battle group, Newbreed called me to say the senator would be inspecting my company. Gus's order couldn't have come at a more inopportune time. I had a big remodeling program going in the unit, and it wasn't quite completed. The mess hall, admin, and arms rooms looked great, but the supply room was a complete shambles. "What about this one?" asked the guys who were working there. "Lock it up," I said. On the morning of Noland's visit, Gus rolled in for a pre-inspection at 0800. Noland wasn't to arrive until 1100, which gave Newbreed 3 hours to provide close personal supervision and not to be aloof to operational detail. In other words, to nitpick, drive us crazy, and do all the things Colonel Johns wouldn't have conceived to do for an honor guard for a 4-star general, much less for some bored ex-senator's blink-of-an-eye walk-through inspection. "What's that?" he demanded outside the supply room. "That's the supply room, sir." "Yes, but what's that?" he persisted, pointing to the padlocked door. I could feel the pangs of insubordination coming on. "That's a lock, Colonel. It means the door is locked." "Don't get smart, Hackworth. Open it up." "No, sir. My supply room is in the process of being renovated. It's closed." "I want you to open that door." "Yes, sir." I let the colonel in. He looked it over. Shelves were down, tools and other building materials strewn around, and sawdust all over the floor. "I want it ready by the time he comes," Newbreed ordered. "Sir, it won't be ready." "It will." Gus bumbled out on his short legs. "Sergeant," I said to the guy in charge, "shut that door and lock it." 11 o'clock rolled around, and so did Noland. "How are you, Senator? Welcome to Combat Support Company. This is the arms room. This is the orderly room. Here's the mess hall and the day room for the troops. That's the supply room. If you don't mind, I won't take you in there. We're in the middle of renovating it." "I understand completely, Captain," said Noland. "You're from California, aren't you?" When Noland finally drove away, Newbreed scurried up, his face red as a beet. "You didn't follow orders. You didn't take him into the supply room." "No, sir, I didn't. I told him we were renovating it, and he accepted that. If he hadn't, I would have let him go in just as you did." "You're relieved, Captain," Newbreed screamed. "Very well, sir." By this stage in Newbreed's tenure, I was just about the only officer in the battle group who hadn't been relieved. Some men had gotten the boot 2 or 3 times. The HQ company CO, Captain Harrelson, seemed to get it every other day. Once I heard it was because someone had stolen some cookies from the colonel's trailer. Next to, "Oh, balls, you're relieved," seemed to be Gus's very favorite expression. Invariably, what happened next was Newbreed would find himself without a commo officer or a driver or a company commander and move quickly to reinstate him. In this instance, he sent Colonel Couch over to see me. Hack, the Colonel's having regrets about relieving you. He wants you to come back. No, sir. No one talks to me like that. The last thing I wanted to do was leave my company, but I also wasn't going to play Gus's game. The ATT's coming up, Hack. The ATT. If we flunked, Unit Pride and the 1st of the 18th would be destroyed for the next 20 years. The worst follows a unit even more strongly than the best, and even more painful than leaving my company was the thought that this obscenity of a commander would degrade the name of the vanguards. So I relented, went back to work, and vowed to let the colonel relieve me whenever he wanted. Besides, I told myself, my time in Germany is almost over. After the ATT, I'd be going on to a new assignment. For some time now, I'd been looking seriously at my options, and they seemed limited to two. One was a staff assignment, most likely in the United States. The other, which I preferred, would take me to a tiny country in Southeast Asia. Throughout my Germany years, it had become increasingly clear that among the world's little wars, one with no end in sight was that of Vietnam. There had been little peace in that country since the French defeat at Dien Bien Phu. The U.S. bank had sunk $1.9 billion in South Vietnam since its birth in 1954, which helped President Ngo Dinh Diem rebuild the war-torn country, but the $80 million spent per year specifically to strengthen South Vietnam's military capabilities had done nothing to slow down Viet Cong VC guerrilla activity all over the countryside. The Cold War dimension of the struggle in Vietnam was stated in general terms by Khrushchev in Moscow 4 days before Kennedy's inauguration. There will be liberation wars as long as imperialism exists, as long as colonialism exists. Communists support such wars fully and without reservation and march in the van of the people fighting for liberation. And by the president. After the nightmare of the Kennedy-Khrushchev-Vienna talks, when he reportedly told James Reston, then Washington bureau chief of the New York Times, "Now we have a problem in trying to make our power credible, and Vietnam looks like the place." A month later, in July 1961, the Americans pledged to increase their advisory training mission from 685 men to almost 1,000, and now, less than a year later, there were more than 3,000 American soldiers serving as trainers for the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, ARVN, with the number, according to a 26 February 1962 Newsweek magazine piece, to shortly double. I wanted to go. Whether or not the conflict would grow into a full-blown war, I didn't know or care. For me, it was just a great opportunity to sharpen my skills. I talked Tim Grattan and Jack Peppers into volunteering with me, and soon they received orders to Vietnam, with language and advisor school at Fort Bragg en route. I, on the other hand, was rejected. Too much combat experience, the guys at personnel said. This knocked me on my ass. How could a potential advisor to a disintegrating army have too much combat experience? Even if I'd given the matter a lot of thought, which I hadn't, it never would have occurred to me that the Army wasn't sending its more combat-savvy personnel to get ARVN on the road to victory. Tim and Jack represented the best of the young officers of the day, but their only experience was ROTC, Standard Basic Officer Training, and their stint with the 1st of the 18th Infantry. How could young lieutenants be of value as advisors to the Vietnamese, a people who had been fighting non-stop for the last 20 years? How could sending highly motivated but inexperienced people to train indigenous troops result in anything more than what was reportedly already there, an inept, inefficient South Vietnamese army? It was early days yet, but it seemed as if the primary purpose of our being there had already been compromised. Only now did it occur to me that in 1962, Vietnam was not just the only war we've got for me as a combat infantryman who didn't particularly want to go to a stateside staff assignment, but for the entire U.S. military establishment. In July, I was finally promoted to major. It was 8 months overdue, but I was on top of the promotions list and absolutely overjoyed. I didn't even mind the rumor that had sprung up over my initial non-selection. According to Ed Savetics, the scuttlebutt was that I'd been passed over for failure to salute a superior officer I didn't respect. Patty and I threw a big party at the Benjamin Franklin Village Officers Club. We planned to have the bar open for 3 hours, but ended up letting it run until the club closed. Phil Gilchrist even came over for the celebrations. He was now a senior major commanding an armor battalion at Kaiserslautern, and it was just a great night. The cost was well over a year's pay between a captain and a major, but what the hell? I was a major. Still, it took a long time to get past 9 years of captaincy. For weeks after, I still answered the phone as Captain Hackworth. Finally, Grattan made a sign, and every time I picked up the phone, he held it up. "You're a major," it read, "you dumb son of a bitch." I finally got the word. The ATT was now fast approaching. Preparations were going well until Colonel Couch was seriously injured in a night field training exercise, FTX. Another M-115 Jeep turned over. Couch was tossed out, and the retinas of both eyes were detached. He was flown to Frankfurt in critical condition, and as soon as possible he'd be transferred back to the States for whatever was necessary to save his sight. It was a tragic accident for both the man and the battle group. Without Colonel Couch around to cover Gus's ass during the test, the 1st of the 18th was going to be in big trouble. Then, out of the blue, Newbreed called me to his office. "I'm making you my deputy," he said. I was dumbfounded. Colonel Couch had to be replaced, but there were 5 majors in the battle group who outranked me, plus Sniffen, who, as a light colonel, by all new army criteria, should have gotten this senior lieutenant colonel billet hands down. Still, a commander will put up with any amount of insubordination as long as the junior officer gets results, Johns had said, and I guessed it was true. I wanted to see Colonel Couch before he was evacuated. The nurse met me at the door of his private room to tell me I could stay only 10 minutes. She took the cake I'd brought, which Pam Savetics had made and asked me to deliver, and I went in to see the colonel. Couch's eyes were heavily bandaged, but his great sense of humor was still in fine form. We had a nice visit, and toward the end, the nurse came back to tell him about the cake. Couch suggested we have a piece, which we did, and then I said my goodbyes and left. On the way down the hospital corridor, I realized I hadn't told Couch that I was only the bearer of the cake, that Pam Savetics was its maker. For a moment, I thought about running back and telling the nurse so she could pass the word along. But no, I thought, screw it. He'll think you did it, and you'll get the credit for being a good guy. Well, take the credit and lay the blame, the motto of the super ambitious. I was becoming just like those I despised, and as I drove back to Mannheim, I didn't like myself very much at all. But to my great, long-lasting shame, I never rectified the situation either. Finally, it was August, and up to Baumholder for the week-long ATT. According to a friend who was one of the ATT controllers at Division, apparently there were grave doubts as to both Newbreed's ability to command the unit and whether a fair evaluation of the battle group could be made with Gus at the helm. All of us shared the same doubts. Nevertheless, rehearsals were over, and sink or swim, it was opening night. As deputy CO, my role basically was to run an alternate battle group CP, in case the main CP took a nuclear hit, went the reasoning, and be prepared to take over or lead a separate task force if required. I made Tim Grattan my S2-S3, took a couple of jeeps and communicators, and fitted out an APC as a mobile command post. I wanted to travel light, like Rommel, whose command style I'd admired forever. The show got underway. Early in the piece, a German hunter in lederhosen wandered into the main CP area, complaining about maneuver damage. He was immediately apprehended. Civilians were not allowed anywhere in the CP grounds, but the hunter refused to leave, demanding to see the commander. Finally, he was taken to the CP. When Colonel Newbreed, who'd been worrying the battle, turned to talk to him, the guy said in English, "I'm not a hunter, I'm an enemy agent, and I've been given the mission to assassinate you." With that, it was kaboom, as the hunter terminated Gus with a blank from his shotgun. The umpire stepped in and told Newbreed he was dead for the next 2 days. Outraged, Gus rose up red-faced from the dead and relieved on the spot HQCO Captain Harrelson, who was responsible for security of the CP area, for the millionth time. I took command. A few Pathfinders were picked up on an open field to our rear. I concluded we were in for an enemy helicopter assault or parachute drop and had the engineer company simulate the seeding of all probable landing and drop zones with AP mines. With a rifle company, tanks attached, placed in the tree line and the engineers instructed to fight as infantry as required, the aggressors fell right into our trap. I found out later that the air mobile assault was the largest helicopter airlift of troops ever attempted in Europe. All I knew at the time was that we absolutely destroyed them, in the process capturing a couple of hundred POWs and winning that part of the battle. We attacked across a river, and all in all, we were doing quite well by the time Gus was deemed alive and allowed to resume command. Doubts concerning New Breed intensified, my controller buddy later told me, when promptly he got lost and placed his TAC-CP in front of friendly lines. But that was not all. He set up his command post in a draw, effectively blocking all radio commo with the maneuver elements. The exercise started to fall apart. Nothing was coordinated. No one knew what was going on, except that at this rate we were going to lose the battle and, far more serious, fail the test. In the meantime, we'd been surrounded by aggressor elements. The controllers took matters into their own hands. They decreed that the battlegroup CP had taken a direct artillery hit and had been wiped out. With New Breed thus killed again, I was back in command. Tim and I moved our TAC-CP up to the highest hill we could find. The battlegroup was surrounded, cut off, and about to be gobbled up. Shades of Korea, 1950-51. And though there'd be no dead or POWs to rot in enemy camps, the honor of the vanguards made the stakes seem just as high. We established good commo with all fighting units, and then maneuvered them into a tight perimeter defense. From then on, it was easy. As Tim described it, we were just drawing circles and arrows on maps and talking to people on the radio. We were not using all the correct codes, but it was like fighting a real battle, and it worked. For me, the whole thing was just plain exciting. I fought the battle group as I'd fight a rifle company. The only difference, as I saw it, was that I had more and bigger toys to play with. Radio reports kept coming in with new situations and the latest intelligence. I kind of felt like a doctor in the middle of a big operation. The doc's primary mission might be a straightforward appendectomy, but he's still always on his toes getting sit reps from the nurses on the patient's blood pressure, heart rate, and whatever else is going. The doctor has his SOPs, but he also has contingencies. In an instant, he has to filter all the info his assistants give him and be able to alter his procedure as necessary, on the spot. On the ground, during the ATT, my decisions based on the latest info seemed to come completely naturally. It came as no small surprise, but I'd never felt more confident in my life. In the middle of it all, I received a panicked call from Colonel Sniffen. A life-and-death reality had gotten mixed up with the mythical war. He said one of his ammo trucks had tipped over in a muddy field. The driver's arm was pinned underneath. The truck was on fire and in serious danger of blowing its load sky high. "What do we do?" asked the senior lieutenant colonel, who, as XO, was in charge of all supply trains. After ascertaining that there were no vehicles capable of winching the truck off or pushing it out of the way, and realizing the kid was going to burn to death or be blown to smithereens, I told Sniffen to get an axe and chop the boy's arm off. He'd lose a limb, but not his life. I went back to fighting the battle group. Last time around, Colonel Johns and Couch had turned the 1st of the 18th ATT upside down by going through the aggressors like the well-known fecal matter through a tin horn, as Johns put it to me later, which resulted in a whole new schedule and artificial delays to keep the thing going. Now, Tim and I worked our asses off to do the same thing. We attacked when we were supposed to defend and threw the whole scenario out the window. We used Larry McDonald's recon platoon as if it were a tank company and blasted holy hell out of the attacking forces. These recon guys found a hole in the aggressor line and spearheaded the breakout. A couple of rifle companies augmented with tanks gained the high ground to cover the rest of the battle group's night retrograde river crossing. When these last defending units successfully withdrew across the river, we'd all but won the little war. Tim and I both worked around the clock for 2 days. When there was no doubt we'd pass the test, the test chief, Brigadier General Clarence E. Beck, had me killed so I could get some sleep and put Newbreed back as the battlegroup CO. Fortunate, in one of my platoon leader's words, that there was one left to command. Beck termed the shambles Gus made of the exercise neither pretty nor pleasant, but as for myself, it had been exhilarating, good fun. As well, the good word came that the boy trapped under the ammo truck had kept his limb and his life. A jeep full of evaluators had arrived on the scene in the nick of time, extricated the trooper, and got him off to the hospital. For a long time, though, I wondered why I'd been the recipient of Colonel Sniffin's frantic call. Shouldn't he have been competent enough to handle the emergency himself? The question remained with me for many years, particularly as Sniffin continued to climb the stairway to the stars and didn't stop until he hit Major General. Leaving the 1st of the 18th wasn't hard. Under Colonels Johns and Couch, we'd been warriors, in our heads at least, and as much as peacetime allowed, 24 hours a day. We'd paraded proudly in battle uniform, complete with shrimp-net camouflage gear on our steel pots, while everyone else wore dress. We'd looked different, and we'd felt different. But without those two old soldiers, the special, spirited unit I'd joined was like any other route-step outfit of 1,500 men dressed in green. Still, it kind of hurt to go without so much as a thank you from old Candy Bar 6 or the Sniff, or a special ER for having pulled their nuts out of the fire at the ATT. Gus was spared even a routine ER because I'd not been in the deputy CO slot for the minimum 60 days. But there was nothing to be done about it, nor, ultimately, did it matter. Newbreed's breed of soldier would always do their damnedest to bring warriors to heel. If they could not engender respect, then they'd work on fear. If they could not engender fear, then they'd simply fix your career by means of an army truism for which there was no recourse. The painful reality that the boss, whether or not he's qualified or even knows what he's talking about, is always right. I spent the last days at Combat Support Company riding ERs for my own boys. Having been burned pretty badly myself, I went out of my way for the likes of Grattan and Peppers, both of whom, even as young lieutenants, I felt would one day be outstanding generals, which indeed Peppers went on to become. Riding ERs was an art form in itself. No longer was a fine, conscientious, good man the ticket to a successful career. Instead, the finest, most conscientious, best man ever to wear the uniform, a God-given water walker, was the shot. Everyone had to be rated as if he were a future chief of staff, and though such inflation made the whole system meaningless, any attempt to evaluate even the best young officer objectively and realistically was, in effect, about the same as cutting his throat. It would result only in an early passover or non-selection for him down the track. I popped into Heidelberg one afternoon to say goodbye to Cybacow, my old partner in the review and analysis section. I figured I'd find him just where I'd left him 2 years before, in our little basement office far from the eyes of the all-seeing. He was there all right, but he was not alone. Our little two-man team, conceived by Colonel Queeg essentially to keep me out of trouble, had exploded into a full-blown staff, a lieutenant colonel, a major, a captain, about 9 whiz-kid troopers and 4 or 5 civilians, doing the exact same thing Cybacal and I managed quite well alone. It was like some living, growing organism that, once started, didn't know how to stop, resulting not in greater efficiency, but in an absolute waste of money and manpower. It would be good to go home. We had a choice whether to fly or ship over. I chose the slow boat to unwind and work Germany out of my system. For me, it had been a period of the highest highs and the lowest lows. JFK's golden Camelot after Ike's barren reign. The boredom of the peacetime army giving way to the wonderful adventure in Berlin. the brilliance of the 1st of the 18th under Colonel Johns trampled in the dust by his successor, Colonel Newbreed, being not selected for major and finding that Johns and, by extension, Rock Reed, Reuben Tucker, and Bruce Clark believed in me enough to come to my aid. Turning 30, then 31, and recognizing a little better who I was, what I wanted, and what made me tick. I had a gift for selecting good men, for putting them in the right jobs, and for recognizing the magic buttons to push in order to get the max out of them. I was impatient and intolerant with the lazy, the incompetent, and those lacking common sense. I came down hard when things were not done as quickly as I wanted and the way I wanted them done, unless, of course, someone else's way was better, faster, and wiser. Even in my increasingly ticket-punching programmed mind, I could not suck up to phonies. I was caustic and openly insubordinate to superiors I did not like. General Tucker once told Rock Reed that I had a flair for shooting myself in the foot with superior officers and that it might do me in one day. He was probably right, but I'd worry about that when the time came. Meanwhile, any man, regardless of rank, who had the potential to stupidly endanger the lives of my troops was my enemy for life. Another of my qualities, for better or worse, was a long, long memory. I was an NCO in officer's gear. I loved to talk to the troops. More than that, I loved to listen to them. In everything but training, I listened to their bitches and tried to make their lives a little better. When it came to training, I kept it up until the bitching turned to boasts, as Colonel Johns had identified in his farewell speech. I had a great memory for my troopers' names and used that talent to let the boys know they were not just faces in a crowd. I wanted to be liked. It was an ongoing since childhood search for approval, but I didn't mind being hated. I took great pride in both the mark I made on a unit. When I left, it was always spirited, well-trained, mission-oriented, and infinitely cocky, and perversely in the lower scores on my ERs, which were always in the areas of tact, tolerance, and discretion. I found myself more and more grateful for having entered the Army through the trust gate and being taken under the wings of Steve Prezenka and other old Army soldiers, even as my trust trooper priorities were giving way to those of a combat-oriented warrior. I even surprised myself the morning I chewed out one of my squad leaders because he'd spent his time shining his boots to mirrors but, as a result, was not prepared for a class he had to teach. "Get your priorities straight," I'd snapped, and for being battlefield, not West Point or ROTC commissioned. Although I'd mostly gotten over my basic disdain for school-trained officers, which was born of my own insecurity anyway, I really believed that I approached the battlefield in a freer, simpler, more flexible way because I'd learned it on the ground, where the unexpected was the norm and all the school solutions in the world were not adequate preparation. Added to the hands-on experience was all the military reading I'd done since I was a kid. I'd lived in my Uncle Roy's World War I picture books and had since read anything and everything I could get on battles and wars throughout the ages. And because it was all independent of formal education, I had to draw my own conclusions, which, remolded and reshaped based on what was happening at the moment, had already proved a great foundation for decisions I would make myself on the battlefield. My next assignment was the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I'd wanted Vietnam, but I couldn't bitch. My lifelong dream was finally coming true. A paratroop assignment with one of the best divisions of them all. I'd resigned myself to the fact that, as a major, I would not command troops. I was well grounded in staff work now, and confident to boot. As long as I just remember to put my feet up occasionally and think, as Colonel Johns had urged all his boys. But little did I know, as the ship neared New York, that for the Army, the days of introspection were over. Part 2. 13. Screaming Eagles. When I arrived at Fort Campbell in January 1965, the cluster of World War II barracks shrouded in a cloud of coal smoke didn't at all resemble my mental image of the home of the 101st Airborne Division, the Army's premier fighting force. But I didn't have a lot of time to think about it. The 101st was definitely the big leagues. To make your mark in such a unit, a second lieutenant had to hit the ground running, and those of us from the class of 64 did just that. We worked hard, and we played hard, and we were damn proud to be members of the best team in the U.S. Army. That Screaming Eagle patch meant a hell of a lot. Brigadier General John D. Howard, Platoon Leader, 101st Airborne Division, Republic of Vietnam, 1965-66. The 101st Airborne Division was rated as one of the U.S. Army's top units. Like its sister division, the 82nd, it had captured the American imagination from its earliest days with jumps at Normandy and Holland. Its roles in the Ardennes Offensive of World War II produced a rich supply of battlefield lore. Immortal words such as McAuliffe's reply of nuts to German demands for surrender, and an unknown paratrooper's, "They've got us surrounded, the poor bastards," in response to the division's plight. The fact that the 4th Armored Division also lays claim to the latter comment in no way detracts from the morale-boosting value it has had for generations of 101st troopers. Though inactivated after the war, in the late 50s, the Screaming Eagles dusted off their parachutes to meet another rendezvous with destiny. With the backing of then-Army Chief of Staff Maxwell D. Taylor, who'd commanded the unit from Normandy to the war's end, the 101st became the Army's first nuclear-equipped division. In October 1962, the spirit of Bastogne was alive and well at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. The paratroopers of the 101st Airborne were lean and mean and infinitely proud. Their parachute wings and scrupulously polished brass shone brightly in the sun as, all over the huge, spotless post, they moved purposefully in cut-down starched fatigues and mahogany Corcoran jump boots. "Airborne, sir," they shouted to passing officers as they executed snappy salutes. "All the way," the officers barked in reply. For me, walking around Fort Campbell for the first time was like a dream come true. Having refound trust perfection in the vanguards, I could hardly believe that now, back to back, I'd found it again. The 101st was ready to go anywhere, anytime, and at a moment's notice. It took a lot of hustle to be prepared to jump 100 different ways, but there was never any panic, it seemed. In an emergency anywhere on the globe, the division could have its first combat element in the air 30 minutes after the initial alert, with a reinforced battle group on the way within 2 hours and the rest of the division following within 36. By comparison, it might take 35 to 60 days to move a heavy in-equipment leg infantry non-airborne or armor division. This ability to deal quickly with the unexpected was a distinction shared only with the 82nd during this 1962 through 65 time frame. In terms of equipment, we were the only two light divisions in the Army. I hadn't been in the 101st for 2 weeks when I got my first taste of the motivation, discipline, and pure professionalism of the crack troops and leaders of the Screaming Eagles. The occasion was Soviet leader Khrushchev's getting caught in his mighty gamble to deploy intermediate-range ballistic missiles, IRBMs, in Cuba, just 90 miles off the coast of Florida. In response, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended massive air attacks on the missile sites and all air defense installations in Cuba. An invasion, too, was planned, in which the 101st and 82nd Airborne Divisions, as part of 18th Airborne Corps, would jump into Cuba and form an airhead while the Navy conducted amphibious operations to subsequently link up with the paratroopers on Cuban soil. It would be like Normandy all over again, and the adrenaline was pumping. At Fort Campbell, plans were drawn, loads were rigged, and the troopers, eager to jump off on a great adventure, were brought to a razor's edge of readiness. Like so many soldiers who grew up in the Cold War, certainly those of us who joined after World War II, I took it for granted, and I think most American citizens did too, that one day the Soviet Union and the United States would square off and go at it. In the meantime, we all lived with the situation as one might live with malaria, never knowing when and how severe the next bout would be, but never really believing it was something we would not ultimately survive, not ultimately win. But then came the Cuban Missile Crisis. It shook all of us, both military and civilian, out of our complacency, at least momentarily. For the very first time, the war of ideology between East and West was not being fought by proxy in China, Greece, Korea, or Southeast Asia, but by the superpowers themselves, and neither Kennedy nor Khrushchev looked as if he intended to back away. I called Patty, who was visiting her mother in Los Angeles, and told her to take the kids and get a cabin in the mountains to ride out the unknown. The specter of war seemed ever closer when, in the midst of the crisis, Castro shot down an American U-2 and another U-2 intruded Soviet airspace near Siberia. Kennedy had called off all overt and covert military operations during the emergency, so neither aircraft should have been up there in the first place. Afterwards, he would say of this breakdown in communication that 10% never get the word. But in such a matter of global life or death, the figure seemed chillingly high. At the 11th hour, Khrushchev accepted Kennedy's firm suggestion that he dismantle and remove his missile sites from Cuba, muy pronto. Neither U.S. airstrikes nor an invasion proved necessary. The Kennedy administration's naval blockade, coupled with the obvious fact that the United States'